Hi everyone, I'm your host Richard Allibone on webtalkradio.net, and this is a very interesting program all about near-death experiences, that is, strange experiences that people report after their heart is restarted to bring them back to life. Experiences like traveling along a tunnel, seeing a bright, wonderful light, hearing what was said during their operation, or even seeing what's going on. Also, they see their own body, sometimes on the operating table, known as an out-of-the-body experience, an OBE. Almost unnatural and impossible to explain, but in this program, my guest is going to give us the result of his 40-year study into these things, and tell us about the medical and scientific evidence he has collected and written about. There is considerable variation in the description of what different people see, but apparently the experiences all follow the same basic pattern. The website of the Near Death Experience Research Foundation gives accounts from 2,500 people, an incredible number of apparently paranormal experiences that have been collected in a few years. They're not all the result of clinical death or cardiac arrest by a long way. Many are experiences that happen in ordinary life. But they all report a similar altered state of consciousness and experiences, so they've all unfortunately become lumped together as near-death experiences, which seriously confuses the situation. My guest today concentrates on proper near-death experiences involving cardiac arrest and resuscitation. He is Dr. Peter Fenwick, a neuropsychiatrist and a fellow of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, who's published over 240 papers in medical and scientific journals, and is chairman of the Scientific and Medical Network, of which I'm a member. So I'm both honoured and grateful to him for being my guest today, Dr. Peter Fenwick.
Ah, hello, Pete.
Okay.
Fair enough. Now, I believe you had, in the course of all your doctors and surgeons' experience, a lot of near-death experiences, or...
I'm a neuropsychiatrist. And so I'm interested in unusual mental states. And I came across a patient of mine who said that after a cardiac catheter, he had the feeling that he left his body, watched what was going on in the catheter room, and went down a tunnel into the light, met the being of light, then into a garden, and then was sent back. Now that is a classical near-death experience.
Yes, and I hear what you say, and of course I'm very surprised looking, as I have been doing in the last day or two, at some of the background there. It's a very common sort of experience.
About 10% of the population have near-death experiences, that's as a whole, but it's also 10% in patients who have cardiac arrest, so yes, it's common.
Yes. It's a fairly normal occurrence. How often, in your experience, have you had this? Or was that just the one person you encountered?
That was the first one which stimulated my interest in the area. Then in 1987, I did a BBC QED program. And it was the first program, first documentary program, on near-death experiences in the UK. Following that, we got over 2,000 letters. At that time, people actually did write letters. And from that, we took out 500 of the best ones that were clearly near-death experiences and sent a questionnaire out to them. We got about 450 replies, and we wrote our first book, The Truth and the Light, on 350 of these. So we've had a lot of experiences.
My goodness. Yes, I had heard, well, I heard you lecture, and I knew you had written a book along with your wife and had studied a lot. I didn't realize there was as many cases as that and such an overwhelming response. Quite incredible.
Is that over 98% had their experiences before they knew anything about near-death experiences. So they had their experiences with no expectation of what it could be or what it was like. Now, that, of course, is impossible now, as it's so well known and so well advertised that it'd be very difficult to get another sample like the one we had.
Yeah. And most of those cases were as a result of some hospitalization?
The interesting thing about this is that it wasn't just due to hospitalization. And it was the first clue we had that the near-death experience was something very unusual and very special. We found out that it was associated with childbirth, with accidents, with serious illness, with shocks where there was no cerebral damage of any sort. So, for example, if you were on a motorway and you had to brake suddenly because of the crash in front of you and the car started to spin, you might have a near-death experience. But when you came out of that, the car would be at the side of the road and you wouldn't be injured at all. So it can occur without any form of cerebral damage. And it can also occur in people who are relaxing and resting, although that's much less usual. So from that, we were able to conclude that the near-death experience did not have at its basis necessarily an alteration in cerebral pathology, the sort that you might see with profound lack of oxygen or carbon dioxide, or with alterations in blood flow in the brain, or, as in cardiac arrest, without the brain apparently working at all.
I'm very surprised about all this because I had made a study of ecstatic enlightenment, whereby people like hunters who are chased by a lion, or one person I spoke to was in a helicopter and hit overhead power lines and crashed. Crashed into the sea, so he wasn't killed. But he had a very similar experience just due to the accident, which has been reported many times by people by lion hunters when the lion suddenly rushed at them. And so it does seem to me there must be a very similar thing which goes on in the brain at that time. What it is,
yes,
I'm
I
not
think that's
sure.
correct. And it's such an important point you're making, because if you just put near-death experiences into Google, you'll see that there are two camps: those who say they're not imagination, this is a real experience, and the other camp says, well, it may be a real experience, but we know that there are specific pathologies which lead to it. For example, too much carbon dioxide, not enough oxygen. Various areas of the brain are affected. It could be possibly due to dreams. It's called REM intrusion, dreams breaking through in the daytime state. There are lots of arguments like that. But anybody who knows the literature knows that whatever pathological cause you choose, you must be wrong, because there are many people who have them without any change in cerebral pathology.
Yes, like the man, well, like somebody, as you suggested, in a road accident. Or is it, do you think, just purely a mental state? I went to classes on one occasion and had an ecstatic enlightenment experience, which this was Maxwell Cade. And he was quite convinced that this sort of thing was due to what he called balanced symmetry in the brain. He measured EEG in a special way. I don't know if you know of his work, but this was a special brain condition which seems to last for a little while, minutes or so, and it brings on ecstatic enlightenment. And it may be that, and I had assumed it was the same with the man in the helicopter crashing. And so maybe this is a common thing which could account for what you've called near-death experiences, which some of them are, of course, near-death experiences, but it seems the same sort of same results in, people report the same things.
That's a most interesting hypothesis, and I think one should certainly consider it, but it wouldn't fit this example. A little while ago, we did a study at Southampton Hospital looking at those people who had cardiac arrests. We did it long ago, so we weren't absolutely certain that the cardiac arrests that people had when their brain was not functioning and they were clinically dead. Clinically dead means their hearts had stopped, they weren't breathing, and their brain was to all intents and purposes dead. In other words, they had no cough reflex or gag reflex or anything like that. Now, if it's true that people at that time could have near-death experiences, then we have to think very seriously about the nature of mind. It's an absolutely crucial experiment to do. So we done by Sam Parnia, who was a doctor at Southampton at the time, and he took 69 people who, if I remember the numbers correctly, it's that order, of people who had cardiac arrests, and found about 11, between 7 and 11 people with experiences when they were unconscious, when in fact they were clinically dead, or so they said. And these people, not all of them, but nearly all of them, had near-death experiences. Now, in those circumstances, near-death experiences clearly are not due to brain function at all, because it's not functioning. So the argument against that always is, well, there's a little bit of the brain which is functioning somewhere. That won't do, because we know that within 11 seconds, the EEG, that's the electrical activity of the brain waves flatten. So that means that there is no electrical activity that you can measure from outside the skull. And so the brain is not working. Are, say, the people who don't understand about brain activity is measured this way. They say, well, if you're measuring it on the outside of the brain, there's a whole lot of brain activity going on inside the brain. Now, that means that you really don't understand the neurophysiology of the brain, because there are three systems which have to be up and running to get electrical activity on the cortex. That's the outer mantle of the brain. And in fact, it isn't done now because people understand this, but a long time ago, people used to put electrodes deep into the brain and see what the activity deep in the brain was when the activity on the surface of the brain was flat. And the answer to that is that it was flat inside as well. So if you can say that the brain activity goes flat, it's not there, after 11 seconds, it means that this is throughout the brain. But these people say that their experiences occurred at that time. So the question you must ask is, how do they know?
Yes, that's a very interesting question. I suppose they don't know, they just imagine that that's a likely answer. Now in this section, Peter, I want to give some more details of the sort of things that people report after their NDE. The main thing that people say is that their lives have permanently changed by what happened. They seem to have a renewed zest for life, be more generous and charitable than before. They are more creative and inventive, and report that they have no fear of death. The experience is generally one of peace, joy, and love, but occasionally it has been distressing with horror and feeling of isolation or guilt. Sometimes there will be a life review, but the whole experience is more real than real, and so is normally remembered as something very special for life. Now, I've just taken all these features of an NDE from the literature, having never concerned myself with NDEs at all before. But the whole list is very familiar to me, and it's just the same as noted by people having had an ecstatic enlightenment or a mystical, blissful experience, which I have studied considerably over the years because of a personal experience of this type. So the question arises, is there a common basis between an NDE and a mystical enlightenment? I'm quite sure there is, and to prove the point, I'm going to read a section from the website of the International Association for Near-Death Studies, IANS. They ask the question, can an NDE be induced through meditation, shamanic drumming, yoga, or other spiritual practices? They say, near-death experiences occur by definition near death, although, as mentioned earlier, NDEs belong to a larger family of mystical or transpersonal experiences that transcend the usual limits of space and or time, and have the potential to be spiritually transformative. Practices such as meditation, shamanic drumming, and yoga can trigger a variety of mystical experiences that appear identical to NDEs, even though the experiencer is not physically close to death. And that's what they say. Now that is very important. You note they said mystical experiences appear identical to NDEs, which is just what I said before. I made a study of mystical experiences, which I reported in my book Sublimity, and in it I said that these experiences are the result of a very deep trance, which can be identified by a special EEG pattern of balanced symmetry at 6 cycles per second. It's not rocket science, but this idea has escaped the scientific world because it's mystical and paranormal, but it seems to be an important clue as to what is happening during an NDE. Clearly, the cases called NDE, which have nothing to do with being near death, are just the same as ecstatic enlightenments, and are the result of deep trance brought on by meditation, or lucid dreaming state, self-hypnosis, prayer, or sudden fear or terror. When it comes to NDEs caused by an injury, the same explanation I think is likely, and I suggest the NDEs of clinical death and resuscitation. Just the same. Clearly, it's not possible for a patient whose heart has stopped and is clinically dead to go into deep trance, but the trance could be either before or after the period of brain death. The people who resuscitated seem to say that these strange experiences happen during the period of brain death, but I'm very unhappy about that. It must be before or after the brain is inactive. So now I'd like to ask my guest, Peter Fenwick, how does science know the experience happens when the brain is dead?
The answer to that is one can't be sure, but there are straws in the wind, which is as high as I can put it at the moment. The first straw is that when people's hearts stop, they in effect faint. It's very quick. So the near-death experience couldn't occur then. Now, after you recover from cardiac arrest, it's called a confusional arousal. That means, first of all, you don't know where you are. Secondly, your mind is obtunded. That means it's all confused and you're disorientated. So there are a whole lot of things like that going on. So it's not normal. And they say that their experiences didn't occur then. So if it can't occur after and it can't occur before, the suggestion is that it occurred during the cardiac arrest. Mm. Now, it's such an important finding because it would indicate, if it's true, that mind and brain are in some way at that time decoupled. And so it means that one has to look at this very closely. And this has been done by a number of scientists who have looked at it. The first one is Sebom, a cardiologist, and he took people who had these experiences in cardiac arrests. And what he showed was that those people who said they were watching the resuscitation process because they'd left their body at the beginning of the near-death experience were much more accurate in what actually happened compared to those who hadn't. Now, the out-of-body experience, unfortunately, doesn't occur to everybody. It's only about a third of the people who have near-death experiences during cardiac arrest. So they're much rarer than the near-death experience itself. So that's one line of information. The next one is that there are exceptional cases. There's one of Pamela Reynolds, which has been hotly debated, and not everybody agrees. But if you take what she says correctly, then when she left her body, she saw the processes of the operation, which was very profound. She was cooled, so her heart and brain activity stopped. Blood was emptied out of her brain. Tumor was removed, and then she was warmed up again. Now, she says that she heard things of what they said during the operation and had a good look at the equipment that they used, which she couldn't have known about. So that's another straw. Some people will say not a good one. Others feel it's quite strong. Now, the next straw in the wind was produced by a PhD student who was working in Swansea. She was an intensive care unit nurse, a lovely girl, and she collected accounts of NDUs in the intensive care unit and in the coronary care unit. And then she did a really interesting study. She again likes her bomb, but this time it's a prospective study, so she got all the data. She found out exactly what the patients who'd seen the arrest said and compared that to the patients who had no experience during the cardiac arrest. And again, she was able to say that people who had seen the arrest were, in fact, much better at describing it. So the argument that it's just all guesses on the part of these people won't hold water. But there are only straws in the wind. What we need is a really clear case of something being identified, which has been put there specially in the room where the arrest takes place. And if they can identify that and describe the arrest and give us a near-death experience and say they were out of their body, then it would be really quite convincing evidence that in some way mind and brain decouple during the cardiac arrest.
Yes, yes, I hear what you say. I have read some of these. I've read the Pam Reynolds case and so on. But I have to say I've had my own opinion about all this. I'm a great believer in telepathy, and I have always felt that the information as to what went on during cardiac arrest was noted by one of the members of the team there, and that as the patient came out of cardiac arrest and subsequently in some way received telepathically the information of what went on during the arrest and was able to explain. That, to me, is an explanation. Now, has anyone come up with that, do you know, as a wild explanation for these things?
Yes, there are a lot of explanations like that. Telepathy is one which is a local form of extrasensory perception. And some people argue for general extrasensory perception. The argument is either that the information is picked up from somebody else in the room, or there is a sort of store of information out there which people can access, and this is what makes them give accurate answers to what the resuscitation was like when their brains weren't working. It's a hypothesis, and at the moment, one hypothesis is as good as any other, that there isn't any convincing information which would lead me to think that telepathy was more likely than other explanations.
No, I understand. But it is all a most fascinating area, I know. And there is a great deal of research gone into this, some yourselves and a lot of other people, and a lot of actual data, which is the important thing. So much of the paranormal is not proper data. This is the thing, isn't it?
Yes, that's absolutely true. Although, mark you, in many experiments that I have seen reported in the parapsychological literature, their methodology is much better than that in some normal routine experiments.
Yes.
Just because you have to be so careful if you're going to get a paper published in the parapsychological journals. Usually their scientific standard is very high in a way that it isn't necessarily in other labs.
Yes, it has sometimes been pretty woolly in the past, but nowadays people know that skeptics are watching every word.
Yeah, and, which is right and proper, because this is, in fact, the method of science, providing the skeptics are open to the data.
No, that's fair enough. It's been most interesting, and I must thank you again. Perhaps if you could mention your book again, people might like to read that.
Yes, our book, The Truth in the Light, was out of print. It's now coming out again this year as an e-book. So it's The Truth in the Light by Elizabeth and Peter Fenwick, and that's the 350 near-death experiences. And we've just published another one, which is also interesting, and that's called The Art of Dying. And this looks at what happens to a number of people as they approach death, and it's totally fascinating. And having asked people in hospices and elsewhere about what happens when people die, it's quite different for some people than the standard idea of just simply switching off. It's not like that. And that book's called, and again, it's all data-based, The Art of Dying.
Mm. Okay. Thank you very much for all that. Yes.
A great pleasure, Richard. Thanks very much indeed.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
Yes. Bye-bye.
And that was someone who knows a great deal about NDEs, Dr. Peter Fenwick. Now, I have a couple of minutes before I close. I've said that trauma will produce the deep trance brainwave pattern that brings about ecstatic enlightenment, and there could be no greater trauma to mind than having to restart itself after resuscitation. So it's logical to suppose that after resuscitation, the mind goes into deep trance, and it is the ecstatic enlightenment which produces the symptoms of NDE. But these symptoms are the same as those that have been recorded for 100 years, which are the result of deep trance of ecstatic enlightenment in ordinary life. I've written about this at length in my book, Sublimity, but I've only just discovered that these symptoms exactly match the NDE symptoms. So it's clear to me that mind startup after an NDE results in deep trance, which produces the well-known symptoms of NDE. Now, another thing we know about deep trance is that it is the telepathic state of mind which we try and achieve when in the Gansfeld. But after our patient has been resuscitated, he goes into deep trance, during which his brain may well receive telepathic information from a member of the surgical team. He would see his own body from above by telepathy, as if out of his body, and he may well be able to give details of this operation, which in practice is sometimes reported. The case of Pam Reynolds is a fine example, but the truthfulness of this case has been in doubt because of the lack of a reasonable explanation. My belief is that trance and telepathy together can explain a great deal, even including the understanding of consciousness, which I have just posted onto my website, which is www.sublimity.org.uk, and then click on the philosophy of consciousness to see what I've written. It's not rocket science, but the addition of an extra ingredient called telepathy makes all the difference. So I think I've rambled on enough for today. I must give a big thank you to Dr. Peter Fenech for telling us all about NDEs and without being too technical. Although people think of NDEs as paranormal, they are fairly common and so quite normal. Join me again next time on webtalkradio.net. This is Richard Allibone saying bye for now.